The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I am Avra Lewis with the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Essence Magazine. The first article is titled, Falling in Love, stars Tessa Thompson and Nnamdi Asomugha, along with director Eugene Ash, offer a sensual homage to Hollywood's golden era. It's the early 1960s, and an elegant black woman in a floor-length teal gown portrayed by Tessa Thompson is waiting impatiently outside a New York City theater. As a black usher tells her the show is about to start, she spots Robert walking down the street, her old lover turned successful saxophonist, played by Nnamdi Asomugha. And so Sylvie's Love, the second effort from writer-director Eugene Ash, begins. With so much Hollywood golden era glamour dripping from the screen, you might miss that the film is set during two movements that awakened the nation. The Civil Rights Movement, which helped the country find its moral compass, and the Women's Rights Movement, which amplified our voice. But Sylvie's Love, which premiered at the Sundance Film Festival back in January and is slated to begin streaming on Amazon this Christmas Day, focuses on our humanity rather than our struggles. Even Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. still had a bunch of babies and fell in love. Ash says, explaining why he decided to focus on capturing life-changing love in his period drama, it's really important to show that we existed in the past beyond the struggle culture, that folks were still falling in love. I think not showing that is a way of erasing us. Tessa Thompson wholeheartedly agrees, and she reflects that the timing of Sylvie's Love couldn't be sweeter. At a time when we are talking about the value and dignity of black life, it is really great to have a love story that offers some escapism for audiences and that feels sweeping and beautiful and hopeful about love. We really need those kind of narratives. Inspired to create this film after looking at old photos of his relatives in Harlem, Ash says he wanted to portray reality of the blackness he saw in those photos on the big screen. I was like, wow, that really reminds me of Breakfast at Tiffany's and movies like that, he says, but I've never really seen those kinds of movies with black folks in them. Thompson and Asomugha play lovers who can never seem to get their timing right. After walking into a Harlem record shop, Robert spots an engaged Sylvie focus on a black and white television instead of enjoying the last days of summer. It doesn't take long for the budding musician to fall in love with Sylvie, an aspiring producer, an ambitious goal for any woman in that time period. For the actress and activist, portraying this character was inspiring. Certainly, women like Sylvie existed during the time, but those stories are not told, Thompson explains. I'm in a period in my career personally where I am launching my own production company, I am working as a producer, and I stand on the shoulders of women like Sylvie who came before me, career women who were pioneers in a time when it was hard enough to be that as a woman, never mind as a black woman. As our culture continues to peel back the entrenched gender roles that still exist today, Asomugha, who's also a producer for the film, says he was heartened that Sylvie's Love shows black male vulnerability. As Sylvie rises in her career, Robert is having the opposite experience. That was important for us to show. Asomugha, who's married to Kerry Washington, says, especially during that time when there was a hyper-masculinity that said, I'm immovable, adds Ash. I wanted to show that black men can be vulnerable because there's a lot of bravado associated with us that, while it's true, has a lot to do with us always having to protect ourselves. Sylvie and Robert's summer love is not without its challenges. especially since it happens right before Robert scores a lucrative gig overseas with his band and right before Sylvie's fiancé returns from the war. None of it is simple, Awesome Moi says of the storyline. None of it is one-sided. Love and life are complex, no matter which lens you're looking at it through. One thing is guaranteed, however, audience will be asking, will they? Won't they? Until the very end. The next article is titled, Mr. Wonderful. Damini E. Ogulu has been making music for a decade as Burna Boy, the architect of Afrofusion. How does he describe the genre? Afrofusion is exactly what it is, he says. It is self-explanatory. Afro, that's the foundation with the Afrocentricism, with the Afro drums and the Afro spirit. And the fusion is where you fuse everything else with the Afro beats, from R&B to hip-hop to reggae to dancehall to rock. Even on a video call from his local room in London, Burna Boy exudes the cool confidence you might expect from one who has been compared to Nigerian music legends Labajaha and Fela Kuti, the latter of whom was managed by Burna Boy's maternal grandfather, Benson Adoniji. The artist doesn't mind the comparison. That's mostly because, in his view, it doesn't mean much, given the general lack of knowledge about the history of Nigerian music. That includes Nigerians themselves, as well as a global audience that has been enamored with other offerings from the continent, from Afrofusion to Afrobeats, not to be confused with Kuti's creation. Afrobeat, the various musical styles, delineate contemporary West African pop music. Burna Boy finds himself less willing to keep clarifying it all. I don't fight it too much anymore, he says. Afrobeat, quote-unquote, is just a name that the UK gave to have an umbrella for African music. Fela Kuti is to Afrobeat, so am I to Afrofusion. So that's why I try to explain sometimes, but then it's like a lot easier to just not. Despite the appearance of capitulation to Western interpretations of himself and his music, Burna Boy is very much self-defined. In his early aughts, he got his start writing songs and making mixtapes. His 2012 single, Like to Party, featured on his subsequent debut album, L.I.F.E., leaving an impact for eternity, put him on the map. His prominence would rise with a score of hits, including Run My Race, On Life, and 2018's Rock Your Body from his third studio effort, Outside, which demonstrated his versatility and worldwide appeal. But it was his African Giant LP, released in July 2019, that brought him international stardom. He later earned a 2020 Grammy nomination in the World Music Album category, but lost out to Beninese singer Angelique Kidjo, who was also featured on African Giant. Burna Boy's outlook on fame beyond his borders may differ from his counterparts and even his predecessors. Everybody wants to be in America. Everybody wants to go to America. Everybody wants to blow up in America, but I want to bring America to me, he says. I want to bring the world to where I am to show them where I am from and what I am representing. In his latest work, Twice as Tall, which hit the market in August, the star says he is telling a more personal story. He also worked with many of his music heroes, including Diddy, who co-executive produced the album, and Naughty by Nature, who influenced him when he was just starting out. And both are featured in a song named after them. In one sense, the offering celebrates Burna Boy's 10-year anniversary in the industry. Twice as Tall is also a lyrical testament to a love for Pan-Africanism, which is passed down from his mother, Bose, who has expressed this passion in acceptance speeches on his behalf at award shows. It comes from his father, who passed it to her, who has in turn passed it to me, he explains. It just goes on. I'll pass it to my children. Like his mom, Burna's sister Nissi also influences his artistry, but she has dominion over his look. On a video call, he is wearing a white hoodie with black writing, the hood covering his almost shoulder-length locks. It is a far cry from his public aesthetic of mirrored prints and patterns and, of course, jewelry. Lots and lots of jewelry, inspired by Nigeria's and the diaspora's traditional and modern fashion culture. It's fitting that the sartorial style reflects his musical style and what he sees as part of his goal as an African artist, bringing the diaspora together while maintaining a strong sense of self. I'm someone who has been exposed to a lot of different cultures, different people, and different places. So I'm very free with who I am, and I am happy, he says. I know what I want you to see me as, nothing more than what exactly I am. I want to look like what's me, and that's it. The next article is called Real Fashion Confessionals. Essence Associate Fashion Editor Nandy Howard sits down with Telfar Clemens to chat about his most recent success. Black style mavens have been able to attain new heights this year, an industry in which curators of color once had a hard time pushing through the door has now adopted a front-facing support bubble, shining a spotlight on some of the most overlooked creatives. While luxury space has made it somewhat harder for black designers to thrive, Telfar Clemens, curator of Telfar, has unwittingly inspired conversations on what the industry determines to be quote-unquote luxury. This year, the Telfar line, which was already gaining popularity with its signature shopping bag, became a cult favorite during quarantine. What was once a New York City insider accessory coined quote-unquote the Bushwick Birkin after a neighborhood in Brooklyn has become a staple piece that can be owned by all. This wide reach is the ethos of Telfar. Not for you, for everyone, the website reads. When the summer began, their bags were selling out in seconds, and most were being purchased by bots that would resell them. To combat this practice during a 24-hour period in August, Telfar accepted pre-orders for items that were out of stock. This allowed users to buy any bag with a guaranteed delivery in 2021. What once made the luxe market so alluring was its exclusivity, but Telfar making a sought-after item accessible to everyone had some asking whether the luxury appeal was being diminished. They make it seem like the ownership of luxury is permanent, Clemens says. If the ownership can't change, what is the point of diversity? Essence asks the question. The last few months have been a roller coaster for a lot of reasons. As a creative, how are you? Telfar responded by saying, to be honest, we are feeling good. We have been black-owned and non-gendered since 2005. That's starting to feel like a years-long head start. Essence asked, of course, you have done many interviews detailing the rise of the shopping bag. I have always felt it has stayed in the bubble of cool fashion kids, but in the last few weeks, it really has reached the mainstream. Do you feel the same way? If so, what do you think is the reason why? Clemens responded, we sold our bag directly because stores don't think there was a customer for it. They were actually kind of right, because the Telfar customer was not someone they recognized as existing. When the people started posting pictures of themselves with our bag, it was like the bag and the person emerged at the same time. To claim that space, Essence asked, I have to ask about rapper Sway Lee throwing black money at the CFDA Awards last year while wearing Telfar. Iconic. What made you all want to do that? He responded, that was beautiful. We actually had thousands of dollars we had dyed black for a photo shoot and never used. Sway saw the stacks and said he wanted them in his bag. The rest is history. Essence asked, no black designers won that night, which you responded to on Instagram. How do you compartmentalize winning the CFDA / Vogue Fashion Fund, but getting locked out the following year at the awards? Do you feel like you were snubbed, or were you just happy to be in the room? Clemens, we are being dragged into that room, whether we are winning or losing, but we make that room look bomb. So at some point, we've got to ask, do you want me in this room to show you are cool with me? Or is it actually to prove that I'm cool with you? The next article is called Sweet Misery, August Wilson's Ode to the Blues. Ma Rainey's Black Bottom may be set in the 1920s, but the unfortunate thing about racism in America is that it never gets old. Director George C. Wolfe retells this urgent adaptation, starring Viola Davis and Chadwick Boseman. It makes all the sense in the world that Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, the magnificent must-see film directed by George C. Wolfe, starring Chadwick Boseman and Academy Award winner Viola Davis, would come out in 2020. Because if ever there was a year of Our Lord that knows something about the blues, 2020 would be it. The story centers around a recording session in Chicago in the summer of 1927. Mother of the blues, Gertrude, quote-unquote, Ma Rainey, played masterfully by a damn near unrecognizable Davis, has come north from her tour down south to record an album. Her band, Glenn Turman, Coleman Domingo, Michael Potts, and then 17-year-old Juicen Brown, awaits her late arrival, as do her manager and the studio owner. Ma lives by her own rules, and she has a deep understanding of the power she possesses, both as a black artist and a black woman. Boseman, in his final film appearance, is electrifying as Levy, a young, ambitious trumpeter who wants his own band, flirts with Ma's girlfriend, and bucks Ma's traditional compositions for a more modern sound. Tensions build as the day unfolds, as the music plays, as truths get told. The film was shot in Pittsburgh, home of Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright August Wilson, whose original Ma Rainey's Black Bottom premiered on Broadway in 1984. This semantic offering is a reunion of sorts. Long-time Wilson collaborator Ruben Santiago Hudson wrote the screenplay, and the film was produced by Tony Award winner Denzel Washington, who played the lead in Wilson's Fences on stage and on screen. After 2 weeks of rehearsal, the cast began filming in the summer 2019, wrapping just before fall. A year later, while the footage was in pandemic post-production, Boseman died of colon cancer at age 43. "It's just too painful and devastating to talk about," Wolf says, "but as an artist, Chadwick was incredibly gifted." "When you are working on anything," Wolf continues, "you want the smartest, most skilled people in the room, because in the end, the conversation becomes elevated, and the talent is there to help elevate it. Then, I think, wondrous and magical things can happen." And so they did. The ensemble members are at the height of their powers here, delivering gut-punching performances that linger long after the credits roll. In this way, Ma Rainey feels so much like a blues song, down to the last frame. And though the story takes place almost a century ago, its relevance to right now is striking. If you'd asked me last year what this film is about, I would have said black migration and what was lost by going north, says Wolf. But in the COVID-19 Black Lives Matter era, he reflects, the relevance has intensified. It's now, to me, about the sins and the scars. How do you go forward when the sins and the scars have never healed? How can you build, trying to go forward into the future, while haunted by crimes and sins of the past? That is not just a black story. That's the American story. The next article is titled, Rewriting Black History. One Night in Miami. Regina King's directorial debut, which will appear in select theaters on December 25th and arrives on Amazon Prime on January 15th, envisions what men Muhammad Ali, played by Eli Gorey, Malcolm X, played by Kingsley Ben-Adir, Sam Cooke, played by Leslie Odom Jr., and Jim Brown, played by Aldous Hodge, might have discussed in the thick of the civil rights movement. when they were gathered after Ollie's 1964 win in Florida. Small Axe Series. The first 2 hours of Steve McQueen's film anthology re-image a scene from 1970 case against the Mangrove Nine, during which one of its defendants, Darkest Howie, sets the stage for the recounting of the incessant racism experienced by London's West Indian community through the decades. This case has seared the consciousness of the black community to the extent that the history of Britain cannot be written without it, proclaimed Howie, played by Roots' Malachi Kirby. The highly publicized case arguably kicked off the civil rights movement in the United Kingdom. Mangrove, which also stars Letitia Wright as activist Althea Jones, is one of five films directed by McQueen and streaming on Amazon starting November 20th. In Red, White, and Blue, another film in the series, John Boyega takes a star turn. The next article is titled, 2020 was lit. In the most difficult year in recent memory, our black literati provided much needed escapes in the form of the written word, from memoirs that made us feel seen to a best-selling romantic novel that reminds us love is never a wasted emotion. Here are our favorite books of 2020. Number 1. Before his death in 2019, Elijah Cummings detailed how he became a man deeply committed to community in We Are Better Than This. Number 2. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Isabel Wilkerson investigates America's entrenched race-based caste system in her deeply researched book, Caste. Number 3. Hugo Award recipient N.K. Jemisin kicks off a new fantasy trilogy with The City We Became, set in New York City as it braces to face an attack by alien force. Number 4. In James McBride's latest work, Deacon King Kong, an ornery old deacon ends up with a target on his back after he shoots a drug dealer. Number 5. A woman on the verge of turning 68 is dealt a life-changing blow and must lean on her sister circle to pull through, and Terry McMillan's is not all downhill from here. Number 6. After twin sisters run away from their southern childhood home at 16, they assume two different racial identities in Britt Bennett's The Vanishing Half. Number 7. For her sophomore effort, Transcendent Kingdom, Yay Gacy zeroes in on a neuroscience scholar who seeks to understand her family as she studies addiction and depression. Number 8. What happens when you notice your black neighbors disappearing and you don't think the cause is gentrification? Find out in Alyssa Cole's thriller, When No One Is Watching. Number 9. Fresh off her royal holiday, Jasmine Guillory's Party of Two follows a black lawyer about to start her own firm when she meets a handsome junior senator who just so happens to be white. Number 10. U.S. Poet Laureate Natasha Trethewey recounts the heartbreaking 1985 murder of her mother by her ex-husband in Memorial Drive, a daughter's memoir. Number 11. The Death of Vivek Oji explores the life and death of a young Nigerian man who secretly identified as a girl during childhood. And number 12. Hitting a Straight Lick with a Crooked Stick, a collection of writings by Zora Neale Hurston, centers mostly on characters in her hometown of Eatonville, Florida. The next article is titled, 10 Things We Are Talking About. Number 1. For the Love of Black Doctors, Bloomberg Philanthropies, the nonprofit founded by former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, donated $100 million to the four historically black college and university Medical School to increase the presence of black doctors and help alleviate their student loan debts. Justice for Tiana. While demanding justice for George Floyd, a 20-year-old Tiana Arata was arrested on criminal charges. The California organizer is now facing more than a dozen misdemeanor counts. Activists want her record cleared and are demanding accountability for the officers involved. Number 3, shifting the culture. A cohort of Lens women have formed the group Black Women Photographers to make sure that the racial reckoning happening throughout the country extends to their beloved art form. BWP has been instrumental in calling for a more inclusive and equitable photo industry. Bring back our girls. Number 4. According to a fairly recent CNN report, roughly 64,000 Black women and girls in the United States are currently missing. Starting early next year, a new podcast, Black Girls Lost, will examine the complexities behind this disturbingly high statistic and shed light on the women's and girls' stories. Number 5, dropping gems. Rock Nation has partnered with Long Island University in Brooklyn to create the Rock Nation School of Music, Sports, and Entertainment. The global entertainment company founded by music mogul Jay-Z will teach a new generation of leaders the ins and outs of the competitive businesses. Number 6, making it count. The country's HBCUs face financial challenges, but a new app, HBCU Change, allows you to link credit and debit cards to the platform. With each purchase, the app rounds the amount up to the nearest dollar, giving the spare change to an HBCU of your choosing. Number 7, ending food deserts. Chantrice Martin, a volunteer with local nonprofit Change Today, Change Tomorrow, started the hashtag #FeedTheWest movement to distribute fresh food to the residents of the primarily black community. Soon that initiative will transition into the Black Market, a black-owned grocery store coming to the area this fall. Number 8, sharing black stories. iHeartRadio's Black Information Network delivers national news with a black perspective. Number 9, head doctor in charge. Namandije Bumpus, PhD, is the newest chair of the Department of Pharmacology and Molecular Sciences at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in Baltimore. Number 10, pay me what you owe me. Wage gap in Washington, D.C. amounts to a loss of nearly $2 million for black women. We have run out of time for today's episode of Essence. We hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I am Ava Lewis, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Essence is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.